Well, good day all, and welcome to Teleclass Portal of Entry, The Missing Link. I'm Paul Weber, and on behalf of Dr. Syed Sattar and the members of the Teleclass organizing committees around the world, thank you very much for taking this time to join us. Now, what can I say about our faculty today that hasn't already been said in one of the five other teleclasses that he's given in recent years? Well, there's probably not much, but I'll see what I can do. Jim Gauthier is an infection control professional at the enormous mental health site of Providence Continuing Care in Kingston, Ontario. He lectures on microbiology and infection control topics through Queen's University. He is a regular feature at infection control conferences across the continent and, in fact, beyond. Several companies hire Jim regularly to speak to their sales reps and their customers about infection control topics, and they fly him to all sorts of interesting places. And today, in fact, he joins us from beautiful North Bay, Ontario, where he is presenting part of the Chica Canada MRSA Roadshow. Jim is in such demand as a speaker because he is really bright, he presents really good information, and because he is an extremely dynamic and entertaining speaker. If you've never seen a live Jim Gauthier presentation, you are really missing something. So, to bring us to Teleclass, Portal of Entry, The Missing Link, I give you the mighty Jim Gauthier. Jim.
Thank you very much, Paul. As usual, a flowery introduction. So what I'm going to look at today here on the Portal of Entry, if we go to the objective slide, which my computer's refusing to do here, I want to look at several factors around the chain of transmission. Oh yeah, we're going to have some fun with this, I hope. But we're going to look at the chain of transmission or the chain of infection. Discuss where I think we are failing in the spread of organisms in our healthcare facility. And I'm going to offer some possible solutions because I don't like just talking about where we're failing things, but I want to try to talk about what we can do to help. So if you go to the third slide, what are we seeing? And in any healthcare facility across the spectrum of healthcare, we're seeing increasing rates of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, or MRSA, to my friends in the States. In most areas, we're seeing increased transmission of VRE, increased transmission of Clostridium difficile, increased transmission of other antibiotic-resistant organisms. Plus, we're seeing a recognition of new organisms, new antibiotic-resistant organisms that I will also talk about through this presentation. And it seems no matter what we're doing, the organisms are much smarter than we are. They will find some way else to cause us problems and grief, either for ourselves or for our patients. So if we go to the next slide, I have a picture of the chain of transmission, or as I like to call it, actually, is the chain of infection. And I've had many discussions around what this should be properly referred to as. This photo here that I'm using, and I'd like to give reference to it, is courtesy of the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care in Ontario. This chain will be appearing in their soon-to-be-released Routine Practices and Additional Precautions document that has already been out, and I managed to swipe this from the draft version of it because it was one of the more clear chains to me. The printing's rather small, but I'm going to work through the different links on this chain, looking at what we've got and where we are at. So if you go to the next slide, where do we spend most of our time? What I find in infection control is we seem to focus on the reservoir, who has a bug, and the mode of transmission, hand washing. I've actually heard somebody make a comment about our most recent national conference about why are there so many presentations on hand hygiene, which made me sort of do a step back going, because that's what we do. We need to have information on hand hygiene and new suggestions. But I want to focus on these two links first. So on the next slide, let's look at the reservoir. Reservoirs, most of you will be well aware, can either be people, food, water, that kind of stuff. And I'm going to hope that our water and our food are okay in our healthcare settings because that's way beyond the scope of this presentation. And if we're seeing some waterborne issues in some part of the world in our hospitals, I'm sure that's something Paul will make a note of for our next presentation. Patient screening is what we do to find the reservoir. And it's effective in many cases. Because when we find that somebody's got a bug like MRSA or VRE, we isolate them if they're positive. Now, Edmund notes that they don't do screening. They sort of focused on the critical care setting, and when they looked at their activities that they put into place. They had a four-year period there where they did multiple evidence-based interventions trying to reduce hospital-acquired infections as best they could. They didn't add any additional surveillance cultures for MRSA. So they launched a big hand hygiene campaign about 4 years ago with feedback related to compliance and stuff that the staff should have been doing. They came out with a best practice bundle for central line insertion. Then they came out with mandatory education on central lines and their care. They developed a DVD. And they put in a bunch of practices, did not do any screening, and found that their MRSA rate did drop. And with a reservoir, when we know we have somebody with an organism, we can do isolation. We put them into contact precautions. And there's numerous papers out there that I don't reference because there's hundreds every time you turn around on how effective it is to utilize contact precautions. The next slide talks about admission screening. I'm curious to watch in the APIC list that many American states are starting to pass laws to do admission screenings on all patients. There's some lobby groups out there stating, let's find out who's got something, treat them totally different than the rest of our patients, isolate them away, and that should help drop our rates. And I'll talk about that a little later on in the presentation here. Some facilities do targeted screening, such as patients that, what we do here in Ontario is we look at patients who have been in another healthcare facility in the previous 12 months, or in a group setting such as a prison, a shelter, long-term care facility, we swab those patients. The question comes up from that is, should you isolate these patients until the screening result is done? I personally don't do that in the other facility. Paul talked about the mental health facility. The second facility that I'm involved with does complex continuing care, geriatric assessment, and rehabilitation. And we receive most of our patients from acute care. About 16% of the patients entering our facility come in with an antibiotic-resistant organism. And even with that kind of number, we don't isolate our admissions until the screening swabs are back. We treat them with routine practices or standard precautions for the Americans, and we see very little transmission because we do focus much more on the routine practices. So the next slide, the admission screening, there's so many different things that we could look for. If we're looking for MRSA, we can swab the nares and perianal or the groin area. Our policy is to screen at least one open wound. We look at exit sites. With VRE, we can have a stool specimen or a rectal swab to look for that organism. For Clostridium difficile-associated disease, there is really no screening available. That one is based much more on symptoms. If a patient develops diarrhea after 3 days in the hospital, that is the first test that you do before you start ruling out other causes of the diarrhea. With the admission screening, then what else are we going to look for? There are other antibiotic-resistant organisms, AROs, and it's a matter of what are you going to look for? Is there a culture media that will make it easy for the laboratory to actually find this organism or not? So the admission screening, once you get beyond the MRSA, VRE, and CDAD, starts to get a little hazy in my mind's eye. So on the next slide, I talk about some of the other problems with it. There's a cost to doing this. I know the PCR, where I am, I think we were going to be billed $75 for a quick turnaround time. For my $75, I can have results the next morning from a swab collected. Do I really need the results that quick if I'm not seeing ongoing transmission? And if I'm swabbing every patient, if I have 50 to 60 admissions, which I do, that starts to add up very quickly in terms of costing my facility. Turnaround time is an issue with screening because the PCR is nice and quick, but some cultures can take up to 5 to 7 days to get results back, especially around VRE off of culture media. Sometimes it's very hard to isolate the organism out. And the admission screening problem that I always feel is that's a snapshot of that day from that site that swab touched. It's really not going to give us a representation. It's not saying for sure there's absolutely not that organism somewhere else hidden on this patient. So it may be a false sense of security when you have a negative swab. The next slide talks about some of the reservoir problems that we will run into, that we have unrecognized reservoirs. And I found some literature on this as I was looking through different things around hand hygiene. Lato in the MMWR was discussing how to handle the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. The antibiotic that falls under the carbapenems are things like imipenem and meropenem are two of the antibiotics that they looked at. And we're starting to see some of our gram-negative organisms, like Klebsiella, for instance, that are resistant to this organism or to this antibiotic. And that's quite significant because in serious systemic infections, this is the antibiotic you want to use. And if you have a resistant organism, it's not very good for the patient to have some problem or to have a good outcome from that. Ferrano was talking about these multi-resistant, or the resistant, pan-resistant means the resistant to everything under the sun, Acinetobacter baumannii. And this is another one of these organisms that was first, I knew of this bug for years in the laboratory. To me, it's sort of related to respiratory secretions is what I think when I see the organism. But we're finding a lot of our military that are coming back from the desert areas, such as Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, are bringing back this organism with them. And it's starting to be transmitted through our hospitals. So should we be looking for this? Should we be looking for resistant Pseudomonas? In Ferrano's study, they actually found in a long-term care facility, they swabbed everybody and looked for the bug and found that 28% of the patients were colonized with MRSA and 30% were colonized with the Acinetobacter in his one study. What I'm trying to say here is there's a lot of people carrying bugs. We're buggy people. And I don't know if we can ever get to the point where we will satisfactorily screen for everything under the sun. So my next slide says contact precautions. Jim has a problem with this. When I do swabbing and we find that a patient has a resistant organism like MRSA, we put up a sign that says contact precautions. If you're going into this room, you need to have your gloves on and your gowns on. And on my next slide, I show what I think the slide is really saying to our staff, and that is contact precautions. We have just found out that this patient has a bug that could be carried to the next patient. Now we really mean you have to perform hand hygiene and try not to soil your uniform. We're not sure about the guy next door yet, so you can do whatever you want. And I've always had this fear that when staff see no sign outside of a patient's door, they're thinking to themselves, he's been screened, he doesn't have MRSA, doesn't have VRE. If we're looking for other bugs, they're not there. And I'm worried that the practice changes because we give them a sign when there's something going on. I'll talk a little bit about this further along. So my next slide talks about environmental reservoir problems is how it's headed. And Dumford did a study in his hospital, which is the Cleveland Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Center. It's a 202-bed acute care hospital. And they didn't go into isolation rooms. They swabbed other surfaces. And 87 surfaces were cultured outside of patients' rooms, and they were looking for Clostridium difficile. They found that 23% of the rooms, the spaces outside, 23% of those swabs were contaminated with Clostridium difficile spores, or the live organism for that matter. 31% of the swabs done in physician work areas were contaminated with the organism. One swab came back positive from a nurse work area. And 9 of the portable pieces of equipment out of the 43 that were swabbed, such as pulse oximetry finger probes, medication carts, barcode scanners on medication carts, had the organism on it. And this is getting back to the environment can be a reservoir. These are getting contaminated from, usually, our staff hands, which aren't being sanitized properly and coming out. Now, the next slide is the chain again, and I'm going to switch here to the mode of transmission. Mode of transmission, I've broken out into contact transmission, droplet transmission, and airborne transmission. Contact transmission, we have both the direct and the indirect. And how we try to break that link is by using hand hygiene. Our alcohol hand rubs are now readily available in most of our healthcare facilities. We still have soap and water available in most facilities. My mental health facility, we don't have sinks in each patient room. So it's not something that's readily available for the staff to use when they're working with the patient within their own room. They have to go and find a common sink if they do want to clean their hands. And with soap and water, we've got a variety of agents out there that we can use in our hands. My facilities have made the move towards not using antimicrobial hand soap. We're just using regular lotion soap and seem to be having no problems with transmission. The other problem with the mode of transmission and contact is if we don't clean our equipment properly, as shown in that previous slide where they swab the environment, we can run into lots of problems. And our toilets, our tubs, pieces of equipment that are used in multiple patients can all be a source of the organism if we contact it and pick it up and then spread it around. The next slide, looking at some of the contact stuff, I looked at some of the studies around this, the hand hygiene focus, and most of the studies seem to focus their hand hygiene education with the healthcare worker. Capretti, for instance, launched a standardized hand hygiene program. They're looking at the nosocomial infection rate in very low birth weight infants, which as a susceptible host is one of our more susceptible hosts for sure. Their birth weights were less than 1,500 grams, so these are tiny, tiny little babies. And what they saw with a very increased program aimed most at the healthcare worker, they were estimating that they would see 10 less nosocomial infections a year with a savings of around $100,000. So that was just putting into effect a very good hand hygiene program, trying to break that link around the mode of transmission. The other study listed up there by Julian, they were looking at a study where you empower your patients to ask, have you cleaned your hands? You know, giving the patients the power. And in their study, the patients thought this was a good thing. The staff bought into it to be asked as you walked into the room, have you had a chance to clean your hands? But I know from feedback that we've received in the province of Ontario around programs like this, the patients feel that's an undue duty on them. They're not comfortable asking. So that's sort of mixed back and forth. The other study by McGuckin that I've got listed here from 2004 was, again, on patient education to ask the healthcare worker if they've done something with their hands. And they saw, by doing that, an increase in hand-washing compliance. It actually did stick around for a while. It didn't fall off as quick as they thought it would. But again, patients aren't comfortable with the asking. There's some issues around that for sure. So we have to take another look at that as we put it into place. The next mode of transmission that I'm talking about on the next slide is droplet. In Ontario, we came out with a wonderful document on febrile respiratory illness. If you want to look at that document, it's available online. If you just Google PIDAC, Ontario, it takes you to their website, and all of the documents, the best practice and recommendation documents, are there, and you can download those for free. And that document basically was trying to get staff that with any patient that is coughing with a fever, or if you're doing a procedure where you may be exposed to respiratory secretions, you need to have face protection on. Wear a mask with eye protection. So any coughing patient, if you're doing suctioning, working with a patient that's in CPAP or BiPAP, doing chest physio, you need to make sure that you're protecting yourself all the time, not just based on a diagnosis. The next slide is talking about the mode of transmission around airborne. That's when we're looking at things like tuberculosis, measles, smallpox, where we want staff to use an N95 respirator or use a PAPR, the powered air purifying respirator. We've got negative pressure rooms. We use that kind of engineering controls to try to break the link around this mode of transmission, that there's nothing going to be in the air, or if it is, we're not going to be able to suck it in. So let's move on to the next link here, the infectious agent. The infectious agent can be numerous things. There's so many different bugs out there. And the expression I always like to use, especially with my healthcare workers, are bacteria and viruses are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. If we look, we're going to find them. And there's not a lot in our environment or in us that is sterile. Definitely nothing on us is sterile. So we can find bacteria and fungi and viruses and parasites and prions, and I'm sure we're going to find some new stuff down the road here that we thought, ooh, I wondered what was causing that illness, and there'll be something else there that we have to worry about. Where do these bugs come from? Most of it's the patient's own flora. We recognize that, that the patient, generally speaking, is going to get infected by their own bugs, especially for things like surgical site infections, and I'll be talking about that in just a slide or two here. Then we bring our bugs in, and when we talk over top of patients or touch our faces, soil our gloves, we can leave our own bacteria and viruses in the patient's environment. And then we have the visitors and families that come in. And I still think of the vast majority of the outbreaks that I have to investigate in complex continuing care and in mental health come from visitors, family, staff bringing the stuff into the facility more so than the patients themselves. And especially with the H1N1 virus floating around and with the mild illness that it presents with, we really have to convince our staff and family and visitors to stay home when they feel unwell. But this is going to be a hard sell at the best of times. The susceptible host link that I'm going to look at here, that's pretty good. We recognize who's at risk of getting an infection. Age, as I mentioned, your neonate in a neonatal intensive care unit is a very, very susceptible host. Your elderly in our long-term care facilities are very susceptible. As we get better and better at suppressing the immune system in people, as they're being treated for their cancers or as they're being given new organs, we have to be aware that these people are very susceptible to getting infections. Other comorbidities, if they have diabetes, people that have a break in their skin, allowing a great portal of entry, or surgery, or Lyme, and then the whole issue around immunizations. Our facility is, again, trying to fine-tune our immunization policy to make sure that every admission is screened. When was the last time you had your tetanus, diphtheria? Are you up to date on your pneumovax if you're over 65 or if you have risk factors? In the flu season, do you have your flu shot? Let us give you your flu shot. Trying to make sure that everybody's immunizations are up to par to try to reduce that risk of having a susceptible host around. I'm really thinking this fall should be real fun around the flu vaccine because I'm sure we'll probably have the best turnout we've ever had as we try to figure out what we're going to do with the H1N1. So we go on to the next slide again. Let's start looking at the portal of exit. as I work my way around. I still haven't got to the portal of entry, but honest, it's coming. So the portal of exit, you know, we're familiar with that. The body fluids that leak out of people can be a problem. Skin, feces, I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember skin and wound precautions and body fluid precautions and enteric precautions and all the other stuff that we used to use based on a diagnosis. We have to also get our staff to get their head wrapped around that when you have someone who is coughing, hacking, sneezing, snorting, we need to protect ourselves from those potential screening or the potential exposure that we would have to blood, body fluids, and other secretions. And how we handle a lot of the portal of exit is with the standard precautions of the routine practices. And again, I've designed my own routine practice sign that I haven't been brave enough to put outside of every patient's room, but if we go to the next slide, it basically reads, warning, this patient has skin, feces, mucous membranes. Perform hand hygiene after contact with this patient or their environment. And that's what I'm trying to give to my healthcare workers in my facilities to remind them it's not just the acronym organisms like MRSA and VRE and Acinetobacter and C. difficile that we have to worry about. We have to worry about any potential source of bacteria and viruses in our environment that could come from anyone's skin, feces, or mucous membranes. I'm the first one to say there is no such thing as good feces. It's all bad. And we should worry about all of it in a very consistent manner. So enough said about that. Let's look at the portal of entry, because that's sort of what we're here for. Where I was coming from with this whole presentation is how do our bugs get onto or into our patients? And when I bring this up with my peers, a lot of times they say, well, it's healthcare workers' hands. And we know that. We've got the evidence. Barbola was looking at, in their study, Acinetobacter baumannii and its transmission via through transient staff hand carriage. And they showed it, that if you swab patients' hands, or sorry, staff hands, you will find this organism, and that's how it's getting moved around. Martinez and their study looked at and recognized that it was hands and poor environmental cleaning that we were spreading VRE. And it goes on. Duckrow looked at VRE transmission in the environment, found it there for sure. Enoch looked at Acinetobacter baumannii again and found it on staff hands, and it was poor cleaning of the environment was their conclusion as to how this was being spread around. Are we spreading it through equipment? Barbola's study also looked at where were they finding the bug, the Acinetobacter, and they found it on 39% of the bed rails that they swabbed and 33% of ventilator surfaces sitting next to the patients in the intensive care unit. So again, our staff is touching the patient, acquiring the organism, and touching machinery in the environment, and then going back again. So you could have staff members putting on clean gloves, readjusting a vent, and then putting the organism onto the patient or into the patient's environment. They may not put it directly on them, but if they put it onto the side rail that the patient can actually grab, that's where I think the link needs to be broken. Is the portal of entry being set up because of poor cleaning? Again, numerous studies that I've got listed here that show that there could be a problem around the poor cleaning. The references here, Boyce was looking at both MRSA and VRE, and they felt that there's an increasing body of evidence to suggest that enhanced cleaning and disinfection of environmental services can reduce the transmission of pathogens, which makes sense. We don't have the bugs in the environment. We're feeling much better around the way things are going. HOTA's study just in 2009 here concluded that surface contamination with VRE is due to a failure to clean rather than to a faulty cleaning procedure or of a product. And what they were finding is if the staff weren't trained well, they just didn't clean effectively. And I think Paul's had presentations on this and how poorly we are cleaning in the environment. And they concluded in their study that with every 10% increase in the number of sites cleaned, you would see a 6% decrease in VRE. And that makes sense. The more you clean, the less bug you should have around in the environment to actually spread. So if we go to our next slide, the portal of entry for MRSA. So where do we usually find MRSA? When we swab patients, we're swabbing their nares, their nose, and in our facility, the perianal space or the perineum or the groin, somewhere nice and warm. Well, how does it get there? I don't know of any healthcare worker that walks around with a couple of fingers, hooks it into the patient's nose to help them sit up out of bed. We generally don't put ungloved fingers up patient's nose. Generally speaking, I don't know of a lot of people that put their fingers in patient's nose. Now, the patient may be putting their finger in their nose. And if we go to my next slide, I believe that's the picture that I've got here. You can pick your friends, and you can pick your nose, but you shouldn't really pick your friend's nose. And my son worships me now because I actually got a picture of Frank Zappa in here, who is his hero, with his finger up his nose, which does worry me too. So if we look at MRSA when we find it on the skin, how does it show up on the skin? How do we get MRSA on the patient's skin? Now, the one study that I listed here, Hasek looked at decolonizing patients that we know have methicillin-sensitive staph and methicillin-resistant staph in their nares. And if we decolonize known positive nares, it cut down on surgical site infections. And there's a lot of evidence around that. This is just the one article that I listed here. When I start finding MRSA on the perineum and in the perianal space, where is that coming from? Is it coming from the GI tract, which means, again, the patient must somehow get it present in their oral cavity to allow it to come out the other end? Is it coming from tubs? Is it coming from soiled linen? Is it coming from the patient's hands as they either clean themselves after a bowel movement or if they've just got hands wandering around on themselves? How does the MRSA get onto the skin? Is my question, one of the questions that I'm trying to answer. If I look at the portal of entry for VRE, and this came up at a discussion around an outbreak, is how does VRE get into our patients? And as far as I'm concerned, there's two entrances, rectal and oral. Now, if we've got rectal entrance, we've got huge problems around how we clean our endoscopes, how we clean our tubs, how dirty are our gloves, because I can't think of a finger going up a rectum without at least having a glove on it in most parts of North America that I'm talking to. There may be other parts of the world where gloves are in huge demand that you may actually have to do a rectal exam without a glove on, and I can assure you the healthcare provider would wash their hands well after doing that. But how is it getting in? So if we look at the next slide, is it oral? Well, I did a presentation for Paul back in 2006 called The Physics of Flying Feces, and you can listen to that if you subscribe to the series. It's still listed in his recordings there. I've actually got the URL that would take you right to it. Or is it us? You know, do we put our fingers in the patient's mouths after touching the environment where there may be VRE? I don't think so. The next picture, I think it's usually going to be the patient putting their own fingers in their mouth. This is how I envision VRE getting into the patient. What's the portal of entry for CDAD? Well, basically the same as the previous slides. As far as I can tell, there's two ways in, oral, rectal, possibly food-based. There's a scary little study by Rodriguez that I've listed here, Rodriguez Palacio, and that was found in, oh, I'm sorry, this isn't on your reference list. This is actually from the Emerging Infectious Diseases from the CDC website, and I'll send the actual link to Paul, and he can post it up with this. It's from 2007. And if, actually, that should be enough information for you to find it through most search engines that we've got now. But what they found, they sampled 60 samples of ground meat from, I believe it was 18 different suppliers. So they went to a variety of different areas, found ground meat. They looked at both ground beef and ground pork, and 20% of the samples, they could detect Clostridium difficile in them. So this might explain some of our community-related illness that we're seeing around this organism. In our healthcare settings, I don't think it's as much of an issue. I would hope it's not coming from the food that way. I think there's another article that I looked at that was discussing the role of proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, causing problems around Clostridium difficile, because these things are made to reduce the amount of acid in our stomach. And they're used, some of this medication is actually over-the-counter, used for acid reflux. And Metz that looked at this, and he was actually writing an editorial around an article, and he felt one of the conclusions of this is we need to look at how we use the proton pump inhibitors, but we also have to remind our patients taking the stuff that their hand hygiene is really important. This is some of the stuff that I started thinking, okay, they're on the right track here. We got to talk to our patients about washing their hands. And then Judy was looking at Clostridium difficile, and they found that there was a lower rate with a hand hygiene program that incorporated not just the staff but also the patients. And they talked to the patients around hand hygiene on admission and the importance of having good hand hygiene once they got to the into their facility. So the next slide, the portal of entry, our patients. And this is where, when I came across this article by Banfield and Kerr, and it's a 2005 article in the Journal of Hospital Infection, the references is in the reference list, and the title was, Could Hospital Patients' Hands Constitute a Missing Link? And I honestly, I came across this article after I've been playing around with this idea, and I'd actually had the title up, and it was through the literature search that Sandra Halliday, a librarian at Queen's University, she did the literature search, and this article appeared in it, that I went, woo-hoo, this is the article, and it was an excellent review. And what she looked at is how bugs are spread around. She looked at they looked at the study, various studies that are out there around, do bacteria survive on our hands? And yes, bacteria survive on our hands. Viruses survive on our hands. organisms survive drying, transfer to another person, and then they're still viable. They found all the studies around this. They also found that the general population have more bacteria on the hands than healthcare workers. They found studies that have looked at this. And then they were proposing here that maybe a lot of the bacteria that we're finding in our hospitals are actually coming in through the visitors and families and patients' hands because they're not as well versed at washing or sanitizing their hands as we would be. They looked at the role of the environment and is it contaminated? And yes, they're finding that there's healthcare workers' hands are picking up bugs from the environment. They listed all the articles that looked at some of this stuff. They talked about Clostridium difficile and my whole premise in the physics of flying feces that you have to ingest the spore in order for you to develop Clostridium difficile-associated disease. And this came up again in this article when they looked at where some of the sources were coming from, how patients were picking it up. And I felt this was very significant around bedridden patients. And sure enough, they found the studies that showed that bedridden patients have a higher number of bacteria on their hands. And that made sense to me. That's intrinsic sense. If you can't get out of the bed to go over to the sink and wash your hands after getting off of a bedpan, or if you're bedridden and they lift you off to put you on a commode and put you back to bed, your hands are going to become more soiled than the patient who can actually go to a washroom and sanitize their hands. So in the next slide, when you start looking at what our patients get stuck with when they come to our healthcare facilities, generally there is a lack of hand-washing facilities for the patients. Or if they're using hand-washing facilities, it's shared in a two-bed, a four-bed, a six-bed, a common washroom down the hall in my mental health facility, a sink that's used for rinsing out personal belongings and clothing that's also used by healthcare workers. We have some issues around our hand-washing facilities, and we're getting better at that. The other issue is the point of care, looking after yourself. So when I'm on a bedpan in my bed because of my broken hip, and they take me off the bedpan, how many of our patients are given something to sanitize their hands with? We're getting better at recognizing this, but I know we're nowhere near 100%. So we look at our next slide. What are our patients coming across? What is happening here around hand hygiene? And I found some other articles that weren't mentioned in Banfield's. But it's stuff that's starting to frame out for myself as to what we're doing with this. So Scott was looking at, do we have bugs in our homes? And yeah, we have bugs in our homes. And they found MRSA and methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus in the homes. And what they did is they looked at both healthcare worker homes and non-healthcare worker homes. And in their study, they looked at homes that had at least a child in diapers and at least either a dog or a cat. And then they compared the healthcare worker to the non-healthcare worker home. And sure enough, they found MRSA and methicillin-sensitive Staph in these people's homes. Especially in the non-healthcare worker, you could find MRSA in their homes. So we know bugs get around. When we have group A strep show up, Jordan's study showed that if we get hand hygiene rates increased in the residents in long-term care, they seem to have a lower risk of group A strep. Makes sense. Tolmick found out that you get a program for patients. The line that they used in their pamphlet was, how the patient can contribute to the global fight against MRSA, which sounded great. You're telling the patient you have a role here in keeping yourself healthy, and it's through the cleaning of your hands. The lower risk of influenza transmissions in homes, Cowling did a huge study where they looked at hand hygiene as one of the modes of protecting people from the transmission of influenza. And they did sort of different studies. One, I think they used a prophylactic antiviral. One, you incorporated just hand washing. One, you got no extra information around your influenza. And they followed the tracking of the organism. And they found that the homes that did perform extra hand hygiene and had some education and were given alcohol-based hand rubs, they found it protective against influenza. It's a nice little study that they did there. And the Smith has always been around in the long-term care guidelines and stuff, and even the most recent guidelines mentioned here in 2008, and I think it was published in ICHI, Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, they recognize that resident hand hygiene program needs to be a part of all infection control programs. And they've been saying this for a while now. We have to incorporate this into the program to keep people's hands clean and keep them healthy. So what can we do? If we look at the next slide, how many of our facilities have the alcohol hand rub right there on the bedside table so the patient can reach out and touch their hand hygiene? We've started to do that now in our isolation rooms. You've got MRSA, you're on contact precautions. We explained that you're allowed out of the room if you're not leaking, if you sanitize your hands. And here's a bottle of hand sanitizer. Make sure you use this on a regular basis. Many facilities are moving towards mandatory hand hygiene before meals, especially in our long-term care facilities or residential care. Our mental health facility, we're trying to do that because they all eat in a common sunroom at the end of the hallway. And we're getting better at it. We're really good during outbreaks. It tends to fall off a little bit when everybody's healthy. And that's something that we need to keep reminding them. You need to have your hand hygiene done before you eat. I think we need to get into some form of a mandatory hand hygiene after use of a bedpan or commode. We really need to make sure that we sanitize our patients' hands effectively and conveniently. If you're getting off of a commode, it means you've probably got some mobility problems. You're not going to be able to go over to the sink and wash your hands. So we have to find a better way of doing this. And I was excited when I started seeing the pop-up wipes that have 70% ethyl alcohol incorporated into them. That will be a good start there because you can get some physical cleaning done if there's some soiling on the hands and there's not readily available soap and water. Or we got to get some basins back to our patients so they can actually wash their hands. The mandatory hand hygiene before and after pet visitation, the study listed there looked at the various organisms that are on pets that were going into hospitals. And it was on subsequent studies that they made the comment that patients need to wash or sanitize their hands before contact with the pet and after contact with the pet, because they started to actually swab the pet fur after it went into the facility to be a visitation animal. And we're starting to find things like VRE on the pet's fur that wasn't there when it went in. So we need to make sure that that link and that mode of transmission of MRSA being carried around by our visitation animals is not going to happen. The next slide is a picture that I took one day at my mental health facility when I came in, and I came across one of these big blue bins that has, we use this to haul garbage out to the loading dock and into the dumpster, and strapped to it is a bottle of alcohol. And the maintenance guy was standing right there when I came by, the housekeeper, and I said, "What's this?" And he goes, "Well, you did a presentation, and you said if my hands are soiled, I need to make sure, or if I've done something that's potentially dirty to my hands, I need to find a way to sanitize them." And he said, I'm all over the building, and it wasn't readily available to me, and so I just strapped it onto my cart here. And he recognized a point of use or a point of care. He needed to have the hand sanitizer much more readily available. And this is long ago. This picture now is 2006, it actually says on the picture. So 3 years down the road, we now have alcohol dispensers all up and down the hallways. So this employee can actually now find the alcohol a little bit more readily available. And I've noticed they're not doing this as much anymore, of actually strapping it onto the cart. But they were listening to what I said. I like using this to show that my talk was being effective when I'm out talking to some of our non-frontline workers. The next slide, this is something that I've been bouncing around. Could we have our volunteers go around before meals and sanitize patients' hands? And what I envisioned is them with a big pack on their back with a dispenser coming off the front of alcohol. This is actually a Ghostbuster costume, I think. But something that could actually go from room to room to room. Here's your tray. Let me sanitize your hands. Bon appetit. Off to the next room. I don't think our staff have the time to do that in most healthcare settings nowadays. Could we have our family doing this? Can we have family reminders that if you're in assisting your loved one with their meal, make sure their hand is sanitized before they eat? Because a lot of patients, when their meal tray comes in, if you watch them, they grab the side rails, they boost themselves up in bed. I've already showed you 39% of the side rails had MRSA on them, and then they feed themselves. So we need to make it much easier for our patients to sanitize their hands. Some of the kickback that I've had when I brought this up is if we put the little soaked pop-up wipes or pledgets that have some sort of a hand sanitizer on them on the patient's tray with our confused patients or our demented patients, they may actually ingest them. It's a problem. I don't know how much of a risk that truly is. When we mounted our alcohol hand sanitizer in our mental health facility, knock on wood, we've had no issue with it. So if you have somebody that is that badly demented, then yes, we need to make sure that their hand is sanitized in another method and we don't end up having them feed themselves VRE or C. difficile. My next slide talks about the frequency of cleaning and disinfection. As we get cuts back in healthcare, I'm a little worried about housekeeping getting cut. That has to be the cornerstone of what we do. The physics of flying feces was looking at where we find feces in the environment. The question, I remember this coming up on the APIC list a little while ago, but how frequently do we change linen in our hospitalized patients? And some of the comment was, well, you know, at home you may wash your sheets every week. And yeah, but I don't live in my bed at home. And I'm now changing my thought on linen frequency change. If we're soiling that linen, the patient is then soiling their hands and then feeding themselves organisms, maybe this is something we need to look at in terms of the frequency of linen changes. Maybe it needs to be more frequently. I still haven't come across a study that looks at how soiled linen gets just by having somebody who is sitting there. The other studies had found some evidence that bedridden patients' hands are more soiled than an ambulatory patient. Maybe this might be one of the sources of it. There's a lot of bad press out there in our healthcare setting these days that hospitals are bad places to be, hospitals are dirty places, we're seeing morbidity, we're seeing mortality, we've got various groups out there saying we have to improve what's going on in our hospitals, and they're all right. Here in Ontario now, it is mandated by the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care that all hospitals post on their website their hand hygiene compliance. That just went up in April. And every hospital every month has to post their Clostridium difficile-associated disease rate. We are also posting our MRSA and VRE bloodstream infection rates. The acute care hospitals are posting their compliance with getting antibiotics on board appropriately pre-op, their ventilator-associated pneumonia rates, their central line infection rates. We're trying to be as transparent as possible. And by doing this, we're getting some funding now put back into the areas that I think it needs to be in for sure. So what are some of my suggestions? Well, these aren't my suggestions. This comes from an article by McCaughey listed down there at the bottom, and I found this in the AARP magazine, the Association for the Advancement of Retired People. And her article went on to talk about things you can do to stay healthy in the hospital, and they're common sense suggestions that you've seen, and some of them I found rather interesting, but I put them down here anyways. Clean your hands thoroughly before eating. Makes sense. Don't touch your hands to your lips. Sounds good to me. Don't place your food or utensils or on any surface except your plate, indicating that your bedside table might be a little contaminated. Ask families to bring wipes containing bleach to clean the items around your bed. When you leave the hospital, assume any belongings you bring home are contaminated. The article goes on to say, don't mix clothes from the hospital with the family wash. Wash with bleach, regular laundry, detergents, do not kill C. diff. There's no references for any of this, but it's just listed. And I thought, some of the suggestions at least catches people's attention. If you visit someone in the hospital, be careful about eating in the cafeteria or the restaurant, where the staff go in their scrubs or uniforms. These uniforms could be covered in the invisible superbugs. More than 20% of nurses' uniforms had C. diff on them at the end of the workday, according to one study, which wasn't referenced. But this is the information that's going out to the public and to our elderly folk through this kind of a magazine to get their awareness up that our hospitals aren't as clean as they could be, and there is some potential risks, rightly or wrongly, out there as we work through. So the next slide is looking at how would we break the chain of transmission. And there's many ways that we can break it. But the problem I'm finding is we don't seem to look at the one around the portal of entry. And because I still think a lot of this is done by the patient self-inoculating themselves. So if I look at my last slide here, and I guess I've been talking faster than I expected, but I'm sure Paul and I will find something to do with the few minutes that are remaining. We need more emphasis on our patient hand hygiene. Not only emphasis on it, we need to make sure that it's there at the forefront. When a patient comes to our facility, they're explained that they are part of this whole picture. They need to take some responsibility for making their hands as clean as possible, but we've got to give them a way of doing that. I couldn't give you a number right now in my facilities what percentage of my patients can perform hand hygiene. I don't know that. I don't think we keep track of that. We do a lot of assessments on our patients when they come to hospital, and we're getting much better at recognizing patients that are at a high risk of having a fall, and we put a special sticker up. We look at risks of patients that are confused and other issues around our patients. We have bed alarms for patients that are, should be in bed and are trying to get out of bed. Do we keep track of the number of patients that can't sanitize their hands? Not that I'm aware of. And this is what I think we need to do. We remind our staff constantly. Here in Ontario, again, we have to audit a certain number of healthcare workers based on the number of beds that's up on our websites. We have hand hygiene programs in place for all employees. It's mandatory education that has to be done. And if you've got time, do something with the patients. What I'm trying to say here in this presentation is I think it's the patients that are doing a lot of the transmission onto themselves from an environment that we create around them. Plus, we're also running into the problem that we don't allow them to wash their hands easily. So we put the side rails up on them so they can't get out of bed. We make them share a sink with two other people or four other people or maybe up to six people, or in some of our wards where it's a communal washroom, I hate to think how many people are actually using that sink. We make our staff share sinks with patients washing their hands. We're now trying to get away from that in many of our healthcare settings, that there's a separate hand hygiene sink for the healthcare worker and there's a separate sink for the patient to use. We've got reminders out there that, you know, we shouldn't be washing our hands in the washroom of a patient that does have Clostridium difficile, that we should be going out. Well, as soon as you leave the patient's room, if you haven't done some form of hand hygiene, chances are in our healthcare environment today, you're going to get interrupted and run into a problem of not sanitizing your hands at all. The last picture that I've got here is our super patient hand hygiener. I think this is something that we need to look at, someone that can actually go around and sanitize our patients' hands that aren't capable of doing it themselves, and it's got to be done in a very consistent manner before each of the meals. Long gone are the days of the nursing staff coming around with the warm water and the face cloth and the bar of soap and lathering up the patient's hands and washing them off and drying them before a meal. I don't think that happens much anymore, at least not in any of the healthcare facilities I've hung around in the past 15 to 20 years. Somebody needs to take some responsibility or offer at least the hand hygiene to the patient that can't get out of bed and get some sink and water. Having it mounted in the patient's room is great for the hand, for the healthcare worker at the point of care. That whole program's working well, that my healthcare staff now in my facilities don't have to take much more than one or two steps to reach some hand rub. But the patient still can't reach it from their bed. And that's what we've got to look at. Can we put some sort of a small personal size one on each food tray that goes upstairs? Probably prohibitively expensive to do that. There will be an issue of some patients that might ingest it. Maybe we need to look at that as part of our patient assessment when they come in. Not only are we looking at the risk of falls and mobility and transfer problems, but do we need to look at the problem of the potential risk of ingestion of other fluids if it was put into their environment? I didn't find a study looking at that, and if you've got some stuff around that, I'd be very happy to have some emails sent to me through Paul that have looked at these issues around it. If you've got some suggestions around how to help out with the hand hygiene of the patients, please let me know. I've been seeing posters at our national conference where admission to the one mental health facility, all patients were shown why don't we do it in our sleeves, teaching you good cough etiquette. And they were saying they've had great response back from the mentally ill patients being admitted in that have watched this video. They offer some treats to get people to actually sit through it. They do a brief discussion around hand hygiene for them and what is expected. Yes, the mental health facility, you don't see a huge amount of contamination and a lot of infections and stuff going on. I find my population in the mental health facility tends to be fairly resilient. We still have our enteric outbreaks that go through. We still have our respiratory problems. But on the whole, considering how ambulatory they are and how much they share, we don't see a lot of problems going back and forth. But I still think it's a good idea to actually have them sanitize their hands and teach them how to do it effectively. So on that, I've got several slides here of various references. Everyone that I mentioned in here, I've got them listed and where I found them. And I will send the last one for that one from the Emerging Infectious Disease to Paul so that he can add it to the presentation. And I guess at this point, Paul, with 13 minutes left, we can try to open it up to questions.
That's great. Thank you, Jim. That was another classic Jim Gauthier presentation. Listen, you mentioned briefly your concept of leaking patients. Can you describe what you mean by that a little bit more fully? Because I think you are the author of that concept, are you not?
Well, there's lots of us out there that talk about it. What I've done is I took routine practices down to about 20 words. And that's after looking at my 15-page document that we've got just on routine practices. And to summarize it in a nutshell, it always boils down to, if they are leaking, protect yourself and limit their movement. And if it's dirty and you've used it, clean it.
And by leaking, you mean?
Leaking, I would mean uncontrolled nasal secretions, respiratory secretions if a patient's got a productive cough, incontinent of urine or feces that's not contained by a brief. That is what I refer to as leaking. Dressings that have to be changed hourly, to me, is leaking. That's a lot of body fluid that's ending up in the environment. And when we get that kind of soiling of the environment, it leads to huge problems around us. And the premise that I try to go around with the leaking gets back to every patient has skin, feces, and mucous membranes. And every patient we come in contact with has some form of a bacteria. And when I start reading the stuff around Acinetobacter baumannii, and they're finding it in patients' wounds, whoop-de-doo, we shouldn't then find it anywhere else. We should do our wound dressing and our wound care in such a manner that we're not soiling the environment. We have to get our staff to understand good glove protocol, that when you put a pair of gloves on, the next thing you do is give patient care. You don't put gloves on and adjust vents and adjust monitors and find equipment and touch everything else in the environment and then give patient care. As soon as you're done doing that patient care, the gloves come off, task specific. That way we will keep the environment clean. And as I looked at all the other organisms at the start there with the MRSA and the VRE and the Clostridium difficile and where they're finding it, none of these bugs are mobile, or motile for that matter. They don't have ways of walking down the hallway off the patient, climbing up the wall, and jumping down onto the handrail. They get put there through our hand hygiene, glove use, and soiling of the environment around us as we work with the patients. And a lot of the focus here in Ontario around the Four Moments for Hand Hygiene program is recognizing that as we enter the patient's space, we got to clean our hands, wash or sanitize. If we touch anything in the patient's environment, we have to wash or sanitize our hands before an aseptic procedure, after potential contact with blood or body fluid, and as you say goodbye. And if we get the hand hygiene up there, that decreases the load that's going into the patient's environment. They will still be touching their environment and touching themselves. And you need to do this. We were doing an orientation with some nursing students at the local college in Kingston. And I asked my coworker, while I'm doing my presentation, watch that section of students over there and count how many times they touch their face. Just sit there and watch. And I went on for about 10 minutes into my presentation, and I turned to Lisa and I said, so what'd you see? And she said, I'm at 35. And she's looking at about 20 nursing students. And I told them, because they had no idea what we were doing. And I said, okay, in the past 10 minutes, this group of people over there have touched their face 35 times. And it's amazing the amount of times that we do that. And if you extrapolate that into our patients, touching the environment, scratching their head, playing with their face, picking their nose, they got an itch, the nasal hair is a little too long, I haven't trimmed it before I came into hospital, and it's bothering me, so I play with my nose, got something caught in my back molar, and I'm digging away in there, there's lots of times that they can feed themselves stuff. Now, I carry alcohol hand sanitizer strapped onto my belt, especially as I travel, and I'm going to be flying home tonight, and I'll go through security with it in a little bag, and I'll take it out again and sanitize my hands before I have my pretzels on the way back down to Toronto. I've got my point-of-care alcohol hand sanitizer, and it's amazing the number of times my seatmate will ask me if they can have some, because they never thought you could carry that onto an airplane, and I like to keep my hands as clean as possible. So this gets back to the whole issue around leaking is we just don't know what's in the environment. And when we have a patient that is got an increased amount of respiratory secretions, a runny nose, and they can't control their secretions, that's enough for them to stay on the floor, preferably in the room that day. Is there MRSA in it? Who cares? Is it a rhinovirus? Who cares? Now, to me, nasal secretions are sort of gross, and that's why they look the way they do, and we should try to keep away from them and make sure they're not getting into our environment.
Good. Thank you. That's very well put. Just before I open the line, and we will still have a couple of questions, I received an email yesterday from Dr. John Boyce, and this came to mind because Jim mentioned one of his references in his slides. Dr. Boyce is one of the, perhaps the leading expert on environmental hygiene in hospitals. He has a brand new website called www.cleanhospitals.com. .net. That's hospitals, plural, cleanhospitals.net. It's a really interesting site, and if you get a chance to have a look at it, I would invite you to do so.
Do you see, Jim, going in the long run in the next few years toward using the same precautions for everybody? I mean, I'm almost thinking like doing away with contact precautions so that we would treat everybody the same way?
I think it's going to be a real hard sell in the infection control world. There is a growing body of us out there that don't see the need for contact precautions unless it's around soiling of the environment. Because if you have a patient that is, you know, using their own feces to decorate the walls, for instance, you know, they've had a brain injury, they don't understand this concept, that to me is contact precautions. Let's warn the staff, you're entering a room where there's a huge amount of secretions. Let's put up a sign to say that. I think we need to get away from the contact precautions, personally speaking, around our antibiotic-resistant organisms because we're getting more and more and more of them. And this is back to the first few slides that I was talking about. Now that we have this Acinetobacter baumannii, and I went to a brilliant presentation that was held down in Michigan by the local infection control group there looking at A. baumannii and where they can find it in the environment and how it's probably aerosolized through some procedures and can float for 15 or 20 feet away from the patient. So it's an issue. And any patient could have an organism like that on them. And I get back, that's why I created that contact precaution sign, because I always felt silly doing it. And I actually had a medical student one day when we were talking about routine practices, and I went through all the stuff that we're supposed to do with everybody, and as I started into the contact precautions, the student put his hand up and said, why do we need this if we're doing all that other stuff that you talked about? And I thought, that's for you. It's about time somebody actually nailed us on that, because what we say doesn't make sense. do this with everybody. Do this, do this, do this. Do it all the time. This is why. Oh, and when we know it, we're going to do it. So very astute question. I don't know if we'll see it in the next 5 years. I think we're going to have to take a good look at what we're doing because of the number of new organisms that are starting to show up. I think we will have to start convincing people. We just can't tell you all the different things that might be present in their feces, all the different things that might be present in that wound, all the different things that might be up their nose or in their respiratory secretions. It's just easier to treat everybody as though they're covered in the worst icky stuff you can imagine, but still provide caring health care.
You were talking about the hand hygiene for the patients. Have you been using any of the little packets of wipes? Because what we do, we put those, give the patients on their trays when they get their meals, so that they can use that to wash their hands before they start eating or wipe their hands. And we're trying to get that out a little bit more so it's closer to the bedside and not have to worry about them drinking or whatever, unless they want to suck on the little wipes. You know, the little ones similar to the 70% alcohol pledges.
Yes. We haven't started doing that yet. And what I would be very interested in, Jackie, and I think it's a great paper, is how many of them are used. Analyze your trays when they come back down. They used, say, 100 on a tray. When they come back down, how many were intact and not used? And you could use that as feedback. First of all, it would make a great article to let us know what's going on. We've now got the individual wrapped ones that are 70% alcohol. I've seen two different companies out now with those. Because traditionally, the pledges that come out, unless you're using the pure isopropyl alcohol that we use for skin prep for phlebotomy, the other stuff that was running around was all down around the 40% and had other things mixed into it, like benzalkonium chloride and things like that. I personally am still of the ilk that we need at least 70% ethyl or combinations of ethyl, isopropyl, and propanol. Take your selection. And the cloth portion of it gives us some of the friction that we might need for soiled hands. As I've seen these come out, I think that's what we need to go through. No, I'm not using them yet. My problem is to incorporate a study like that and look at the cost. I don't think I have a transmission in my building. I need to find a hospital that has an ongoing transmission problem and see if they would introduce it and do the study for us.
Yeah, actually, here we use the contract for our nutrition and food services, and they provide it on the trays. So I'll follow up with our director of the nutrition and see what they're seeing when the trays come back and then maybe formalize something to really get a read on whether or not they're being used or not. But the way I was looking at it is some is better than nothing.
That's true. And, you know, you're right, something is better than nothing. But at the same time, if you're going to put the effort to do it, let's get something that is effective as best that we can tell.
Thank you again to all of you for your participation today. And Jim, a wonderful job. And thank you very, very much again. You can, of course, expect another invitation for next year.
I'm looking forward to it, Paul.
All right. Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.